Hey, welcome back. Okay, let's get this started in the infections. So briefly, I want to talk about Lyme. The technical name is Borrelia. Lyme, the treatment philosophy for Lyme is support collagen structures, because it's the spirochetes have a real affinity and addiction to collagen and soft aqueous membranes, the brain, eyes, cartilage. So supporting collagen structures in the body, enhancing the immune system, shutting down the inflammatory pathways, treating symptoms, and then adding antimicrobials to go after spirochetes. So Lyme disease is an infection caused by a spirochete bacterium. The scientific name of the bacteria is Borrelia burgdorferi, and it's called the great imitator because its symptoms mimic other diseases. It can affect any organ and particularly loves aqueous membranes, brain, heart, nervous system, muscles, joints. Early in the infection, if you're very lucky, you will find a tick or you'll have a rash. Almost immediately, not always, many people experience flu-like symptoms. Depending on immune function, the flu-like symptoms may be the only thing that happens, and then it resolves. It may be the only thing for a very long time, usually until a trauma or some sort of reinfection with another illness. And trauma is really important to pay attention to, because if you or one of your clients is going along, they're improving, then they've plateaued and they have some quality of life back, and they're improving, and then all of a sudden they start showing more symptoms or they crash. I always look to what was happening in your life then. Was there an emotional trauma? Was there an upset? So finding out a trauma is really, it's an instigator for a flare or a reinfection or a downward spiral. So if there is a rash, it can extend over several inches and over a period of several days. It's at that time of immediate infection, if there's a rash, or you suspect, that's when antibiotics can be very, very helpful, right, early on, immediately. And also bringing on an herbal protocol at the same time. Sometimes timing is of essence early on the infections. Lyme rashes can mimic spider bites, ringworm, cellulitis, and even satellite rashes all over the body. So even, they're again thinking outside the box, you know, don't be looking for just a bullseye rash, any kind of a rash. If you've been in an endemic area, if you've been hiking, if you've been exposed, paying attention to what's going on and what the signs your body is giving you. And those rashes are actually the spirochetes moving through the body. As many of you know, the longer Lyme goes untreated, the deeper the infection goes into the systems, the greater the symptoms. The spirochete can hide out in the immune system for years, sometimes decades. It can be months or years later you notice you're having heart difficulties or cognition difficulties or skin rashes, digestive trouble, arthritis, reproductive system diseases. And symptoms may disappear even without treatment, and different symptoms may appear at different times. So I'm going to talk just briefly about diagnosis and testing. So based on primarily on typical symptoms and testing, though testing is not an exact science, as many of you know. The diagnostic tests that are being used, a rash can be a diagnostic tool. Indicator. And we're still hearing that the phrase is, no positives, no Lyme. The primary challenge of testing for Lyme is that the spirochete grows too slowly in cultures. which are often used for bacteria, they're not practical for Lyme spirochetes. The most common tests measure the patient's antibody response to infection. When your body is invaded with Lyme spirochetes, your immune system makes antibodies to fight the infection. So antibody tests are indirect because they measure the body's response to infection rather than the presence of bacteria. So in the first 4 to 6 weeks, most people have not had time to develop a critical mass of antibodies to be reliably tested. Many physicians will not prescribe antibiotics without a positive test, so you can see the problem with early antibiotic use. It's one of the problems with testing for the presence of spirochetes, and then the disease gets a foothold because of the time span. Treatment should really not be delayed pending a positive result if there is suspicion of Lyme infection and you've been exposed. So some of the herbs can be really elegant. They're antibacterial herbs, antibiotic herbs, antispirochetal herbs, Japanese knotweed should be, you know, at the top of your list. Lyme-aware physicians and practitioners will look to both test results and their intuition, their clinical judgment and experience, and symptom picture. They'll look at symptom patterns, risk factors, exposure, a client's immune system. And you can tell a lot about a person's immune system by the way they present themselves and their energy. You know, everybody knows about energy. It's that invisible thing, but it's a real. You know what Californians used to call in the 60s energy? It really is energy. You know, you can see if it's coming. What? The vibe. So, you know, assessing a person's energy level will tell you some things about their state of hope and their internal immune system. Exposure history, examination findings, test results, response or lack of response to treatment, these are all have to become part of a diagnostic bundle. So still the two primary tests, there's the two-tiered approach, the ELISA, which looks at antibodies, and this is a little murky territory for me, so I'll see if I can talk about it briefly and clearly. So the first antibody to appear is the immunoglobulin, IgM, which if you've had an ELISA test, you've all seen the IgM on your test results. That shows up usually within the first 4 to 6 weeks following exposure to the infection. That tells you it's an early recent, right? Is that right? Is there physicians? IgM is recent. So while the immunoglobulin is doing the initial job of invading the organism, the immune system of the body is creating the IgG. It's a specialized antibody against the organism. Once IgG appears on stage, often the IgM will begin to drop. So levels of IgG antibody can and often do remain elevated indefinitely following the initial response to the bacteria. In chronic unresolved Lyme, it's not uncommon to find ongoing elevations of IgM antibodies along with IgG antibodies because of active ongoing antigen presentation by the macrophages to the lymphocytes, including the body, to make IgM constantly. In other words, the IgM will often be made until the chronic infection is either effectively treated or is under control by the immune system. So the false negative and false positive, those readings come out. That what that means is false negative means an underdiagnosis. A false positive is an overdiagnose. The ELISA is not accurate, so anyone with a positive, whether it's a true positive or a false positive, will then have a second test, usually the Western blot, to confirm and rule out whether it's false or confirm a positive. True positive. And that's the Western blot. So that's how those two tests work together. The other tests that are showing a little bit more accuracy is the PCR. And it's an antigen detection test. And PCR is the polymerase chain reaction test. PCR multiplies a key portion of DNA from the Lyme bacteria so that it can be detected. While While PCR is highly accurate, when the Lyme DNA is detected, it produces many false negatives. That's because Lyme bacteria are sparse and may not be in the sample tested. Antigen detection tests look for a unique Lyme protein in fluid, for example, blood and urine and joint fluid. Sometimes people whose indirect tests are negative are positive on this test. So that's why I'm creating, for practitioners, creating a multiple diagnostic toolkit, if you will. And you all, I don't know if you picked up the handouts out there, there's a glossary, and in the back there's resources for test and talks about a lot of the terms that I'm using. So the other one is the CD57, which is a helpful test to have. It tells you a lot about the state of your white blood cells, your natural killer cells. And those are aggressive white blood cells. And it's the CD57 is a fairly reliable marker. It tells you specifically the state of your white blood cells. So CD57 drops when the spirochetes are established. So your normal CD57 white blood cell count should be in the range of 100 to 200. So if it's below 100, that is a red flag that there's some infection going on. So the Lyme symptom picture is particularly skin, joints, collagen. And if your skin starts to get a little thin, transparent, there's severe collagen degradation going on. Joints, heart, nervous system. The spirochetes can actively invade the cerebral spinal fluid. Early signs and symptoms of Lyme infection is dermatoborreliosis. You know, skin borrelia. Lyme expression in the skin. After entrance into the human body, the spirochetes actively begin spreading throughout the tissues. This is where the erythema migrans, or the EM rash, happens, that some people get upon being infected. It's the sign of the movement of the spirochetes throughout the tissue, close to the surface of the skin, actually. Though it's not a reliable diagnostic indicator for people who are infected, because only about 37% of people infected have a rash, and of them, only about 10% will have detectable spirochetes in their blood. And a secondary EM rash in late-stage Lyme is not uncommon. Symptoms are joint pain or Lyme arthritis. The initial infection can cause aches and pains in joints and muscles. It can reach the knees and infect the knees within days of infection. These bacteria move pretty quickly. There'll be flu-like aches and pains, chills, fatigue, high fever, flu-like symptoms, night sweats, severe muscle pains, especially in the large muscles of the legs, the quads, the buttocks. Those are early symptoms. Late-stage symptoms become more neurological symptoms, dizziness, tipsy, spaciness, feeling altered, feeling like you've stepped off the mountain onto a cloud that's floating. Air hunger, that breathlessness, not that feeling of not being able to get a good deep, you know, that deep cleansing breath. It's shallow and it's a struggle to get a breath down deep into the diaphragm and the bottom of the lungs. Non-productive persistent cough, spleen or liver enlargement, lymph gland swelling, headache, migraine-like headaches, Bell's palsy, light and sound sensitivity, cognitive impairment, memory, concentration becomes difficult, challenging, depression, stiff neck, radiating neck, shoulder, stiffness and pain, severe fatigue, abdominal pain, nausea, diarrhea, chest pain, palpitations, tingling, burning, shooting pains, meningitis, lymphocytic meningitis. So working with these infections, even though we've been working with Lyme disease a little bit longer and more with more awareness, this is an experiment. It's not definitive. as you know, I mean, you try something, you keep adjusting, and so not be hard on yourself if you try something and it doesn't work. It just takes focus and relentless focus and patience and willing to keep trying and adjusting and bringing in new things. Antibiotics work for some people, they do, but they don't work for everyone. And it may take for up to 30 days to be effective. Symptoms will persist or worsen, or Herxheimer reaction during those 30 days. For some people, multiple rounds of antibiotics over long time or long periods are necessary. Lyme symptoms are a problem for these people and are often the reasons they keep coming back for more antibiotics. For some, antibiotics don't work. Either the symptoms fail to resolve or they only partially resolve. Herbal regimens can be designed for each of these groups of people to help protect the sites where symptoms are occurring, to reduce the symptoms, and alleviate suffering. One of my indications of people will often say, they'll give me clues about whether antibiotics are for them or not. If they say, I can't take antibiotics because they make me sick, or they make worse, then, you know, it's not going to work for them. Or I can only take plants. I can't take antibiotics because I don't believe in them. Or they're outside of that paradigm. So a person's orientation with pharmaceuticals plays a big part. If you don't think they're going to work, chances are your body's going to be struggling, your belief system, your values, all those invisible things that work inside of you, part of your immune system, there's going to be a conflict there. So listening to what your client is telling you, their belief system plays a huge part in this. Or if they've been taking, they did antibiotics early on, it's 6 months later, the protocol is helping, but it's just not popping for them, and they say, you know, I really believe the antibiotics worked, I felt better. They're a good candidate. It can be remarkably effective, the herbal protocols. It will need to be adjusted per individual needs and tolerances. And again, the protocols outlined are for an average 150-pound person and at the maximum doses. So if you want to use these for a child, then you take their, how's that work? Take the child's weight, take the 100, something like that. There's math involved. I can't do it. But like a 50-pound child, so that would be a third of the dose recommended for an adult.
And it goes the other way too?
It can go the other way. It can go higher. Typically, the maximum dosage, which is, so if you have a 500-milligram capsule of Japanese knotweed, and you're taking, starting out at 1-3 times a day, and you build up to the maximum, which is 4 capsules 4 times a day. That might be enough for a 200-pound person or a 250-pound person. It might take more. It might be that a 200-pound person can only take homeopathic doses. Depends on the sensitivity, how their nervous system is, how sensitive it is. So, for example, Devil's Claw is exceptionally helpful for the pain of Lyme arthritis. Stephania root for reducing edema. Especially useful are natural products to support the body during antibiotic use, such as probiotics for the GI tract. Maybe juicing fresh vegetables to detox, to help the body detox. Because as you're using herbal antibiotics and pharmaceutical antibiotics, there's going to be die-off that your body has to move through. So keeping the detox pathways open and supporting them and facilitating, and there's a number of ways that we can do that. We'll talk about later. Well, some of them, you know, lymphatic massage, because the lymph are heavily involved in, as cells are, and viruses, bacteria are dying, they go through the lymphatic system. And so supporting the lymphatic system to keep those things moving out of your body, keeping your bowels moving, sometimes sweating, sometimes colonics are needed. Employing an anti-inflammatory diet as reducing cytokines and reducing symptoms so that you're not adding to the inflammation. You know, fish oils, coconut oil, good fats. And using the core protocol to reduce symptoms and the spirochete load. So the core protocol, as I said earlier, is still intact. It's a Japanese knotweed, cat's claw, and andrographis. So andrographis, using the above ground parts, it's anti-spirochetal. It enhances immune function. It protects the heart. Is anti-inflammatory, it crosses the blood-brain barrier. This is where herbs can get really elegant because pharmaceuticals, it's rare, if ever, they can cross the blood-brain barrier and get into the brain or get into the joints. Herbs can cross the blood-brain barrier pretty elegantly and effortlessly. Andrographis enhances liver function, protects the liver, helps clear infections from the body, protects against neural degeneration, accumulates in the central nervous system, the spinal cord, the myelin sheath, the brain. Specific indications, which means if these things are going on, it's an indicator that andrographis is indicated. Is that legal? Brain fog, confusion, arthritic inflammation, low immune function, pain, headache, chronic fatigue. The dosage for andrographis is typically, again, this is a generic protocol that needs to be adjusted. Sometimes this, as it is, works beautifully, but andrographis can cause some andrographis rash. If you notice that, then it's important to discontinue the herb. The rash will resolve in 2 to 3 weeks. A remedy for that is homeopathic apis. So the dosage is 400 milligram capsules, 1 to 4. That means and 3 times a day. So 1 to 4. You'll start out with 1 3 times a day for about a week. Your body's adjusting to it. And then the next week, 2 3 times a day for another week. 3 3 times a day for another week. And then the max is 4 times a day. And you stay at the maximum dose for a minimum of 60 days. About 60 days. And that dosage protocol is identical for knotweed and cat's claw. So if you start these all together, then you can get into a regimen of 1 of each 3 times a day, 2 of each 3 times a day, until you sound like a maraca, a rattle, when you're walking around shaking because you have so many capsules in your gut. It's a lot. It's a lot. I get obsessed about my body and health if there's anything out of whack. So I take the protocol. Everything I have. Almost everything I suggest to my clients, I'm taking for a number of reasons. I want to keep my immune system healthy, and I want to know how the medicine's working inside of me. I want to know what it feels like. And it's not a true test because I have a pretty strong constitution, but nonetheless, I'm making a personal relationship with the medicine.
Could you say the tincture dosage as well?
Could you repeat the question?
Maybe. She wants to know the tincture dosage. Okay, this is where I can go back and forth. I'm missing the DNA sequence that allows me to think in numbers. Okay, I'm blessed with a lot of things, but not that one. So typically, I would say 400 milligram capsules. I would start with, let me calm this down. I might go, especially with andrographis, which can cause a rash and some GI tract stuff, 1/4 teaspoon 3 times a day. And honestly, I don't know how that translates. Somebody here probably does. But this is a good, this feels really good. It feels solid. So 1/4 teaspoon 3 times a day, 1/2 teaspoon the next week, 3/4 up to 1 teaspoon. Some of these you can get up to 1 tablespoon. But again, trust your body. And what it's telling you, what its tolerance level is. If if a teaspoon or 3 times a day feels really good, but you just feel like you just got this sense that, you know, maybe more, then try more.
Is it preferable?
It's really what you're going to be compliant with, what's going to be easier. When it gets to like 16 capsules alone of knotweed and cat's claw and andrographis, that's daunting. And then you add on top of that anything else for specific symptoms or other infections, getting yourself or a client to be compliant to take all of that stuff. So then you get real creative and real permission giving. So I have some people that are mixing and matching. They are making their own decoctions or their own tinctures, which cuts down on costs. And again, they're making relationship with the herb. They're making their own medicines. And so some are taking decoctions, some are making their own tinctures, some are using capsules, some powders making teas, some powders are just putting it in juice and throwing it down. So compliancy is important, and being flexible and not dogmatic about the form, but go for what feels good, what's the essence, what's going to support you or your client taking the medicines. Okay, does that make sense?
Am I correct in hearing that this is good for an immune system building, these three?
They are good for building the immune system.
So it's good for, like, maybe candida or other things?
Some of these are very good for candida. I'll mention some of them later on as I get more into the materia medica. Yeah. So they're anti-spirochetal, antibacterial, immune-enhancing. Japanese knotweed, which I'll talk about in a minute, is specific immune modulator, which means if your immune system is low, it brings it up. If it's too high, it brings it down. Beautiful.
Julie?
Could you make a tincture of all three of them put together, like, you know, if you have to put them all together? And
you could theoretically. What I would prefer is to make individual tinctures and then blend them, make a formulation. And that's a good point, because you can take, if you have individual ones, there's no reason you can't put all of these in a little bit of water and drink your herbal cocktail. No reason at all. And I know this question is going to come up, so food, no food. I don't know if there's any rules, but my working theory about it is tinctures, because they're extracted in alcohol, take a tincture in, it's going to be absorbed into the bloodstream immediately through the stomach lining. That's my preference, priority. If they cause nausea, which can lead to, I don't want to take the herb because it makes me sick, take it with food. I mean, I have preferences for the way to take them and the timing of it, but again, work with what you've got. Be flexible. Don't be hard on yourself because you're not doing it by the book. You're doing it for you. That's what's important. Cat's claw. There's a lot of different cat's claw on the market. It's important to make sure the cat's claw you get is the inner bark of the vine, not the root. The root will work, but it's being over-harvested, and if you take the root, you're going to kill the plant. So make sure it's the inner bark of the vine. This particular species, Uncaria tomentosa, comes from the Amazon. It is an immune potentiator and immune modulator. So it will potentiate the immune system until it gets to a certain point, and then it will regulate it. It's anti-inflammatory, analgesic, painkiller. It enhances the central nervous system, addresses cognitive impairment, specific for arthritis and muscle pain. It's antiviral, analgesic, I already said that, anticoagulant. It's a blood thinner. It's anti-dysenteric, so it's good in dysenteries involved. It's a blood cleanser, detoxifier, systemic tonic, diuretic, and a wound healer. It addresses the central nervous system symptoms, enhances cognition, cognitive impairments. It's specific for arthritis and muscle pain in Lyme disease. It specifically increases CD57. Remember before the break I was talking about white blood cells? Maybe it was this time. But it specifically increases white blood cell counts, raising your immune response to the white blood cells. For chronic Lyme that presents with regular relapse accompanied by weakness and fatigue, cat's claw is strongly indicated. It's specific for late-stage Lyme, chronic Lyme, Lyme disease that does not respond to antibiotics, especially with the low CD57 counts, specific for Lyme arthritis, chronic fatigue, neuroborrelia. It reduces edema in arthritic conditions, for memory deficits. It relaxes the central nervous system. So you ever have that feeling where your nerve endings are just feel like they're hanging on? It just relaxes. It protects the heart and heart functions. It's an overall tonic for the whole system, the whole human system. And it enhances feelings of well-being. So the dosage for cat's claw is 500 milligram capsules, and exactly the same as Andrographis 1, three times a day, two, three times, three times, three times, four times. If you're using a tincture of it, I would use the same dosage that I gave you earlier, but color is important with this. With cat's claw tincture, the lighter the color, the stronger. Just the opposite of Eleuthero, right? So lighter, more potent. And then increase or decrease as in response to symptoms or GI tract upset. It can cause, again, GI tract upset. If you get to three times a day and you start having upset where two, three times a day didn't, then you can bump back to that and stay at that for a while. Try to increase it again later on. And you don't have to go from two, three times a day to three times a day. You can go from two, three times a day to two times and three, one day. Does that make sense? Did I say it right? Sometimes my brain works in funny ways. Okay. Contraindications for cat's claw. Shouldn't use cat's claw if you're using stomach acid blockers, because stomach acid facilitates movement of the herb and absorption and movement of the herb. And it needs stomach acid to do that.
Would that include short-acting, like Crohn's and stuff?
Well, some people say short-acting, but they use it every day. So, no. It would include that, so that would be. But if you need it one time, then you'll just keep taking cat's claw. It's fine. Okay, so stomach acid, don't use with organ transplant immunosuppressive drugs or blood thinners. It is a blood thinner. And that with Japanese knotweed, you've got a potent blood thinner in your system. And on that note, if you know you're scheduled for surgery, then 10 days before surgery, discontinue these herbs. Okay, Japanese knotweed. What a cool herb. Anybody know this plant? Is it growing near you?
I'm actually in Oregon and I grew it up for years and years. Invasive, exotic.
Yeah, it's an exotic. You know, the leaves are heart-shaped. It's beautiful. Get your attention driving by it. Waves. Really beautiful plant. And very, very important for these emerging diseases. Its roots go 6 feet or more into the earth. Often it will grow along stream banks so that during floods and high waters, parts of the root will break off, and it will, what an ingenious way to spread it, propagate itself downstream. So those who harvest it also facilitate an internal strength inside themselves. You have to dig the roots usually early in the spring or late in the fall. And Japanese knotweed crosses over into a number of infections. It's functionally active in other infections, and I'll bring it up again later. So it's a very, very, very useful plant. It's useful in Bartonella, Mycoplasma. Its actions are, it's antibacterial, antiviral, antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, central nervous system relaxant, anti-spirochetal, antifungal. It protects the brain and spinal cord. It's an oncogene inhibitor, so it's an anti-cancer herb. It's an antioxidant, anti-ulcer, it's astringent. It's a really great herb to have, too, as a wound powder topically. Heals things almost overnight. It's a magnificent wound healer. I love this plant.
So it's a cell regenerator?
It is. And it brings, and it increases microcirculation in the whole vascular system. So imagine increasing microcirculation. It's going to bring blood and oxygen healing cells to the wound site. It's a great wild food plant. The early shoots, like asparagus shoots. It's a great source of vitamin C. It can, on occasion, cause the loss of taste. And interestingly enough, I started taking tincture of this again recently in the last month. And after about a week of taking it, I was going, I know my tongue feels kind of funny. And I've got this sort of metallic taste in my mouth. I still have my taste, but it's doing something to my taste buds and just have this metallic sort of taste. It's not horrible, but it's definitely got my attention. But the benefits way, way, way outweigh the disconcerting taste. Function in Lyme disease, it's broadly systemic. It goes through in your entire system, every organ, blood, brain. It modulates and enhances the immune system. It's active against gram-negative and gram-positive bacteria. It's anti-inflammatory against arthritis. It's a premier herb for Lyme arthritis. Protects against endotoxins, which means it can help reduce Herxheimer reactions. It protects the heart, crosses the blood-brain barrier, where it exerts actions on the brain, the central nervous system, and the spinal cord. It protects against oxidative and microbial damage. It specifically protects the brain against bacterial infections, microbial endotoxins, and inflammatory damage. It enhances blood flow, especially to the eyes, heart, skin, joints, making it especially useful to reach spirochetes in hard-to-reach places. It's a synergist, which means it potentiates the actions of other medicines and herbs, even pharmaceuticals. So if you're taking a pharmaceutical antibiotic and taking knotweed, knotweed's going to make the pharmaceutical more potent, more effective, and it will do the same thing with other herbs. And it has tremendous implications and applications in emerging diseases. I prefer to use the whole herb, the whole root. It's becoming more important as the spread of West Nile encephalitis, SARS, hepatitis C, HIV, antiviral, antibiotic. It's antifungal. The only contraindications is it's a blood thinner, so be aware of that. And it is contraindicated in pregnancy. So most of these herbs, unless it specifically says do not use during pregnancy or the early part of pregnancy, most of these are fine to take while you're pregnant, unless it says, you know, has a warning about it. But predominantly, most of these are fine to take while you're pregnant. I have more and more clients are making decoctions out of their herbs, especially if they're harvesting knotweed themselves or a friend is harvesting it, then drying it, powdering it. A Vitamix is really useful for these things. Powder as much as you can. So just a brief, I think I put a decoction recipe in here, but if I didn't, I'll give you one now. So a basic one is 1 ounce of powdered dried herb to 32 ounces of water. You simmer that for 20 minutes. I bring it up to a boil and reduce it immediately to a simmer for 20 minutes. Cool, strain, and then drink that in 4 equal doses during the day. And that should be incrementally increased. So going up to, you know, a week or 10 days later, going an ounce and a half. I don't like to take vitamin C, but I was noticing, you know, I'm 53 years old, my skin was getting thinner, and it was becoming disturbing to me, so I started taking 3 to 6,000 milligrams a day, and within a week, I started, the integrity of my skin increased. It got stronger and healthier looking.
Is there a particular form that you use?
Steven suggests powder, and I've used the powder, and it's very good, but I don't like it. And if you don't brush your teeth afterwards, it's, you know, ascorbic acid and the enamel thing. So I cheat and take capsules. And I like the 1,000 milligram capsules because it's easy to dose and regulate. You know, vitamin C is water soluble, so your body will use everything it needs, and what it doesn't need, you just pee out. Or if you take more than it needs, then something else happens. Although it draws water into your GI tract and you have diarrhea. In that case, you just go back off on the dose to tolerable doses, which is comfortable. Powder, the best one I've used, though, is from Wholesale Nutrition. And it's really affordable and it's good quality. It comes like a whole bunch of grams like this. And it will last a long time. It's like $35 for a big, huge thing like this. And it has potassium in it, too. It's got other good stuff. And that's in the back of the book, some of the resources for ordering stuff. Okay, so vitamin C for collagen support. Selenium is really important. The daily dose of selenium is 200 micrograms. So a lot of selenium supplements on the market. But I'm a big fan of getting vitamins and mineral nutrition from food. One Brazil nut a day will supply you with your daily recommended allowance of selenium. Yeah, I don't like Brazil nuts. But it's just one. Stefania. And Rachel just introduced me to a collagen powder she puts in her food last night. But I don't remember the name of it.
It's a Great Lakes gelatin.
Great Lakes gelatin. It tasted kind of good.
Yeah.
It's good.
And it's a selenium source?
No, it's a collagen powder.
Oh, okay.
They have it at Halo.
Mm-hmm. The dose is 1 tablespoon a day.
1 tablespoon a day.
What's it from?
Grass-fed cows.
We got bone broth.
About what?
Bone broth.
Bone broth, yes, bone broth. An ancient remedy, bone broth, for healing just about anything that ails you. Pine pollen, testosterone. Pine pollen, it's the best source of free testosterone. Well, in the spring, when the pine trees are pollinating and the air is orange or yellow, then you take little bags over the ends of the pine branches and shake it off, you've got pine pollen. You can put it on your food. You can eat its raw, whole raw food. You can make tinctures out of it. Woodland Essence makes theirs from Scots pine. Scots pine actually has the highest levels of testosterone.
And what's that for?
Pine pollen?
Yeah.
Pine pollen is the most bioavailable form of testosterone, but it's free testosterone, so your body converts it to testosterone, estradiol, whatever it needs. You know, beautiful, elegant. Yeah. But it's also important in collagen support. And strength, muscle strength building, endurance. For joint inflammation, arthritis, teasel, vitamin A, D3. And these are additions to, you know, the core protocol does a lot of these things. These are additions to keep on your radar.
Can I ask you a favor? If there's anything in particular that's not in the book, for people who have the book,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm trying to, yeah, trying to keep this part brief because that's been out long enough that it's kind of
something new that isn't in the book. Can you just make a little note of that?
Yes.
Right. This isn't in the book.
Okay, like this. Turmeric, coral root, Indian pipe, greater celandine for pain. That's not in the book.
What
turmeric, curcumin, which comes from turmeric in the peppers, coral root, coral, C-O-R-A-L, coral root, grows in the high Rocky Mountains. Elk Mountain Herbs is a good source for coral root, elkmountainherbs.com. It's a really good pain remedy. It's and it's also a good psychological remedy. So coral root, it's called coral root because if you dig out the roots, it looks like coral. The roots look like coral. They're beautiful, delicate, coral-looking roots, and they kind of fall apart. They crumble if you're not real careful with them. So if you have somebody or you or yourself feel like you're falling apart, coral root is indicated. Put you back together. Indian pipe, it's also called ghost pipe, grows in damp, probably grows out here somewhere, damp, moist forest. It's mycelium, white. It looks like a white pipe coming up out of the ground. It works. You can use the above ground and below ground. It works on the pain centers of the brain like morphine without morphine side effects. Indian pipe. Yes, it's a mushroom of sorts.
What?
Yeah, they're in the same. Yeah. So is that a mushroom or a mycelium? Thanks. Okay. Greater celandine. I'll talk about more later in great depth, but greater celandine, the Latin is chalidonium. Does anybody know that plant?
Yeah.
Yeah? Does it grow out here? It's an implant, yeah. But I was experimenting with this the other day because I have a really bad habit of getting myself under a tremendous amount of stress with massive tension headaches in the back of my head and neck. And rather than my default going, you know, take 6-8 ibuprofen, I just experiment with celandine so I understand this. And within 20 minutes, I had taken probably 30 drops, 20 minutes, it was dissipating rapidly. So experimenting with these because our pain thresholds, the types of pain is different for everyone. Let's see, those are some of my favorites. So memory, cognition, that's talked about in the book. Muscle twitches, crawling, neck pain, tension. I came across this new one recently that I've only, I don't have a strong relationship with it, but it's a Chinese herb. It's called Gao Tang, G-O. Do you know it? For twitching and muscles and that tension. No, it's not. It's a different, it's not the same plant, but it makes sense to, yeah, because it's called the hook. It's a hook.
That's cat's claw.
It's a different species, right?
Different.
G-O-U, right?
G-O-U.
T-E-N-G.
It also settles the nervous system. It kind of anchors
the hook. Yeah. Oh, and I'm just remembering other stuff about it. I took it specifically because of this tension and headache, but also I've been having liver trouble lately. It's a little inflamed and just not happy. So it cools, in Chinese medicine, it cools liver heat. Sedate liver yang rising. Okay. And the other one I've been working with too is niacin. I just came across, anybody familiar with the Townsend letter? It's online. It's a brilliant resource. There's a lot of research going on and they're not biased. They're really clear and really cool people doing some interesting stuff. But there's an article on there about niacin for the central nervous system. And they talk about, you know, Edgar Cayce used high doses of niacinamide and Bill, the founder of AA, use a lot of it for withdrawals and just nervous system support and healing and protection.